Greg, and he's going to talk to us on rheumatoid arthritis, and we want to thank the Tanner Clinic for sponsoring his presentation.
Good morning, everyone. I'm thrilled to be with you today, and I am grateful to the Ogden Surgical Medical Society for inviting me to speak today. It's really a privilege, and I get a chance to speak today about one of my favorite topics in the world, which is rheumatoid arthritis, although I've learned over time that it's not everybody's favorite topic. In fact, my own program director in internal medicine admitted to me one day that he hated rheumatology. He just didn't get it. He didn't understand it. And so that surprised me, but as you think about it, there's sort of this still mysterious error about rheumatology and how it works. We talk about rheumatism and some of the old terms that you still see patients coming in and asking you about. And you know, some of that may occur because of the very word we use, rheumatology. Rheum itself, the word rheum is actually Greek for that which flows or flux. And if you remember your old humoralism, disclosures, by the way. Objectives today, before I get started, I'd like to understand or help you understand the mechanism of action of some of the biologic medicines that we use. I'm going to be spending most of my time on those today because that's where most of the advances in rheumatoid arthritis have been in the last few years. I'll be talking about updated guidelines for the diagnosis and management of rheumatoid arthritis. Obtain updated guidance about appropriate vaccination schedules for patients with rheumatoid arthritis, and then we'll talk about some of the recommendations for perioperative management for these patients. So this is what I was getting at with the humoralism. Remember the blood, the bile, the phlegm, those evil humors that it used to be that were blamed for causing all of the disease states, and so you'd have physicians who are bloodletting and so on. Well, we have better names for these evil humors these days. We call them inflammatory cytokines. And there's been a lot of work over the last few years trying to name these inflammatory cytokines and determine what they do. Well, when those inflammatory cytokines are working like they're supposed to, it's much like the river you see there on the left with a flow that is very organized and is very peaceful. But when the inflammatory cytokines go out of control, it's like trying to control somebody on a raging whitewater raft. It can be actually quite scary. On this slide, you see some of the inflammatory cytokines that are associated just with synovitis in rheumatoid arthritis. And I'll be focusing, of course, mostly on rheumatoid arthritis this morning. You can see that there are a variety of inflammatory cytokines that have been indicated in multiple stages just of synovitis, with initiation of synovitis, the perpetuation of the synovitis, and then, of course, the chronic stages of synovitis. You can see interleukins are involved, and tumor necrosis factors involved, and interferons are involved, and there are a variety of them. The ones that you see in yellow are what really make this exciting, because these are the ones that have FDA-approved indications for their use. And, you know, sticking with this this theme of flow and, you know, trying to keep track of all of these new medicines that are coming out is like trying to drink out of a fire hydrant. So hold on to your shoes and your hat for just a second. So I'm going to be talking mostly about the newer biological medicines today. And it's difficult because all of them, of course, have generic names and they have trade names. I don't endorse anyone, and so if I slip this morning and use a trade name, I apologize. I'm not trying to endorse any specific one, but so that you can keep track of which one I'm talking about. You'll see infliximab at the top is Remicade. Adalimumab is Humira. Etanercept, Enbrel. Golimumab is Simponi or Simponi Aria. Certolizumab is Cimzia. Abatacept is Orencia. Tocilizumab is Actemra. Cerulimab is Kevzara. Rituximab is Rituxan, tofacitinib is Xeljanz, and Anakinra is Kineret. Now I'll be using the generic names for the rest of the talk. By the way, these slides are on the website in case you want to go back and look at these again. So for the better part of 20 years, we've really enjoyed an explosion in this advancement of treatment for rheumatoid arthritis. We have multiple mechanisms of action. The TNF inhibitors include those that you see, and we've briefly discussed a second ago, T-cell therapy. We have B-cell therapy with rituximab, interleukin-1 receptor antagonists, anakinra, and we have two interleukin-6 receptor antagonists. I'll talk about all these in turn. There is one other one that's relatively new over the last 3 to 4 years. This one's exciting because it's the first oral medication that is biologic-like for our patients. They really enjoy not having to inject themselves or coming in for an IV infusion. It's called tofacitinib, and it's a Janus kinase inhibitor. So let's talk for just a minute about the TNF inhibitors. These TNF inhibitors have been out for nearly 20 years now, at least three of them. Infliximab, you'll see here, has it's a monoclonal antibody, but it's chimeric. It actually has a murine hypervariable region, which makes it different from some of the others. Infliximab is an infused medication, generally every 8 weeks. Going on to adalimumab here, this one is a fully humanized monoclonal antibody against tumor necrosis factor. And then etanercept is a fusion protein that has been engineered to do the same thing, to target TNF and knock it out of the system. The other two that you see here, sertolizumab and golimumab, are newer. This one also is fully humanized, much like the adalimumab is. This one is dosed every 2 weeks or every month, depending on the formulation. And this one, its claim to fame is that its hypervariable FAB portion of the antibody is pegylated. And so this pegylated portion of the antibody purportedly keeps it in the system longer and keeps it from being cleared from the immune system. Abatacept is the T-cell inhibitor I mentioned just a minute ago, and this is interesting. You remember from immunology that an antigen-presenting cell becomes activated, and in order to activate the rest of the immune system, or specifically T-cells, it has to interact with a T-cell via the MHC molecule and a T-cell receptor. That antigen is represented there. And then, in order to not allow this system to go out of control, there is a co-stimulating molecule, or an interaction here between CD80 and 86 and CD20 that must be there in order for this antigen-presenting cell to activate the T-cell. So what we have here is abatacept, which interrupts that co-stimulating molecule. And when that happens, that signal does not transduce, and that antigen-presenting cell is unable to activate the T-cell, and the T-cell undergoes apoptosis and is cleared from the system. Pretty ingenious. Rituximab is the B-cell inhibitor, and how this works is there is a monoclonal antibody that is directed against CD20, which is a marker on premature B-cells. So what that means is when you infuse this medication, which is infused typically every 6 to 9 months, because it has its effect that lasts for that long, it knocks out an entire generation of premature B cells. And so people will generally enjoy a long remission of symptoms. It's indicated by the FDA to be used with methotrexate, but I have people that have had rituximab dose, and had no symptoms for upwards of 4 years with a sustained remission. I do have other people, though, who need the rituximab every 6 months or so in order to control their disease. Anakinra is an IL-1 receptor blocker. This one is a little bit different than the others in that it doesn't target interleukin-1 specifically, but it targets the interleukin-1 receptor. So what we have here is a cell and a cell membrane. We have a representative interleukin-1 receptor here. Typically, interleukin-1 will bind to the receptor and then cause a cascade of inflammatory signaling that will go to the nucleus and cause gene transcription of other inflammatory cytokines and activate the rest of the immune system. What anakinra does is it actually binds as a monoclonal antibody. It binds this IL-1 receptor so that it cannot function, and thus the signaling transduction does not occur within the cell. Similar to this, we have two interleukin-6 receptor antagonists, tocilizumab and sarilumab, and they work very similarly to the other, where you have an antibody, a monoclonal antibody that's directed against the interleukin-6 receptor and effectively knocks out its function. So IL-6 cannot activate its IL-6 receptor, and again, the inflammation doesn't proliferate. Now, I mentioned the Janus kinase inhibitors are a new kind of molecule. It's given orally, which patients really enjoy. And how this one works, let's say that this is just a generic cytokine receptor. It doesn't matter which one. You have whatever its correlating interleukin is that's trying to activate this receptor. Typically what happens is Janus kinase is closely associated with this receptor, becomes phosphorylated, and then it phosphorylates another molecule called signal transducer and activator of transcription, or a STAT molecule, which then goes into the nucleus, and believe it or not, it transcribes there the DNA through DNA transcription, the inflammatory cytokines that it wants to generate to affect the rest of the system and cause inflammation. So what happens with these JAK inhibitors is that the phosphorylation never occurs. So JAK is inhibited, there's no phosphorylation to STAT, STAT is inhibited, and hence there are no further inflammatory cytokines that are generated, there's no signal there. That's how the JAK inhibitors work. Now I want to make just a quick point here. Of course, all of these medicines are immunosuppressive. And so before starting a medication like these, we have to make sure that they've been tested for tuberculosis. We have to make sure that they've had chronic hepatitis screening because, of course, these medications can cause major issues with patients like that. The other thing is that always remember when a patient comes in to see you who's immunosuppressed, the very first thing on your differential diagnosis should be infection because it's very common that they're going to be coming in with infections, and remember that their symptoms will not always be typical for what you would anticipate. Now in 2010, the ACR, American College of Rheumatology, and the EULAR, the European League Against Rheumatism, came out with newer diagnostic or classification criteria for rheumatoid arthritis, which are very helpful. The reason why they're helpful is that it's much more conservative in enabling us to make a diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis. You'll notice here that you only really need synovitis in one joint without another cause for synovitis. And then there is a list here of things for which you get certain number of points in order to make your diagnosis. I won't go over these specifically, and you might look at that and say, well, I can't remember that. Well, guess what? I can't remember it either. And so I just look it up when I need to. But this is very important for me because we know that patients who are diagnosed early with rheumatoid arthritis and treated aggressively have a much better prognosis over time, and they're easier to treat. I want to spend a few minutes on the 2015 guidelines for the management of rheumatoid arthritis. These guidelines come out every 3 to 4 years and are available to anybody. You can Google this. And there are a lot of recommendations here about how to treat patients who have hepatitis or who've had solid organ malignancies or lymphoma. There are lots of great recommendations there, and I'm not going to go through all of those today. But we'll be talking about some of the specifics of treatment with the medicines, since that's what I want to spend most of my time talking about today. You'll notice here that we still use what's called DMARD therapy. Remember, disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs. They are the first-line therapy still for treating these diseases. We don't go straight to the biologic medications because, number one, there's sometimes not a need to do it. Number two, because of cost. We're looking at upwards of $60,000 a year to treat patients with some of these biologic medications, and so we start with the oral DMARDs first. So for anybody with low, moderate, or even high disease activity, the ACR recommends starting with an oral DMARD therapy. So as a reminder to you, we use methotrexate, we still use leflunomide, we use sulfasalazine. Occasionally you'll see azathioprine used or hydroxychloroquine. We also sometimes will still see patients being treated with cyclosporine, which doesn't happen very often, and occasionally I'll see a patient come in who's been started on minocycline. But a combination of things of these medications can also work quite well. Now, if you start an oral DMARD therapy and the patients aren't responding very well, you can add some of the other medications. And there's an interesting point I want to make here. So in developing countries where they can't get their hands on a $60,000 a year medication, they have shown that certain combinations of medications, oral DMARD medications, can work almost as effectively. So we call that triple therapy. It's hydroxychloroquine, methotrexate, and sulfasalazine used in combination with one another. There are situations in my clinic where, because of insurance issues or because of a chronic infection or some other reason, something like maybe active chronic hepatitis B, I don't feel comfortable giving a TNF inhibitor. And so I will treat patients with the triple therapy, methotrexate, sulfasalazine, and with hydroxychloroquine. And they do surprisingly well. And there's a lot of argument, if you were to look at the research about this, whether or not we should be starting with triple therapy versus going straight to a biologic because of expense. So if you do go to a TNF inhibitor or one of the other biologics, you can add that and typically add it to an oral DMARD because all the studies show that, in general, treatment of RA goes better when you take one of these biologics and you use it with an oral DMARD in combination. So we still know that combination therapy works better. Now, what you always hope for, is, of course, is that you have low disease activity. If that's the case, you can continue the therapy that you're on. If you look at them and the disease seems to be in remission, you can actually start to wean the therapy off. And sometimes I'll bring their dose of methotrexate down as low as I can get it, for instance, and get them on the lowest effective dose possible. And then, of course, there are those people that, regardless of everything we do, they blow through everything we have. And then we end up having to go back to the drawing board with other biologics, combination of TNF with an oral DMARD. Remember that we never combine the biologics. You never combine one biologic with another. I wanted to spend a few minutes about on immunizations now. So there have been some updated recommendations about certain immunizations given, and I got this as a combination from the ACIP website, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, and from the same 2015 guidelines I just quoted from the American College of Rheumatology. They are that, first of all, in patients on biologic medications, they should not receive live vaccines. And I've gotten this question a lot lately, of course, with the zoster vaccine, the older zoster vaccine. That is a live vaccine and should not be given to patients on immunosuppressive therapy. And anybody else who might, you might be tempted to give them an MMR or a varicella vaccine. If it's a live vaccine, they should not receive it. There are the two pneumococcal vaccines that are available, and these patients should receive these. The 13-valent is a one-time dose in their lifetime, at least until the recommendations change. And then the 23-valent with a booster at 5 years. So if they're on immunosuppressive therapy, you can throw out the guidelines about age. They need to be vaccinated against pneumonia. According to the guidelines, they should be vaccinated against influenza yearly. Both men and women should get an HPV vaccine. And then a hepatitis B series should be given to those who are at high risk for hepatitis B. I mentioned just a second ago the herpes zoster virus. There is the newer recombinant zoster virus vaccine. After I went through these slides, created the slides, just within the last week, they've come up with an update on the recommendations about how to give that. So they mentioned any patient above 50 who has a chronic medical condition, they should get, including those that have already been vaccinated with the prior zoster vaccine, they should get the recombinant vaccine. But they stopped short of giving any recommendations about people who are significantly immunocompromised, with the comment that they would be making that available at a later time. So more to come on that. Now, everybody knows that rheumatoid arthritis patients are at an increased risk for infection, particularly when it comes to surgical procedures. So I wanted to talk for a few minutes about perioperative management of these medications for our surgical colleagues here and for others that are interested in knowing when to stop these medicines. From 2008, which was just a couple years after these biologics started coming out, there was a study that concerned people, of course, from Arthritis Care and Research, and it showed out of 462 patients with rheumatoid arthritis who received hip or knee replacements, there was a 3.7% increased risk of joint complications with an infection. And they noticed some things like revision arthroplasty and a previous prosthetic joint infection with replacement were increased risks for infection, which doesn't surprise anybody, and that rheumatoid arthritis patients were more likely than osteoarthritis patients to have an infection. In other words, step lightly when it comes to doing surgery on these patients. In 2017 now, we realized, this was just December 2017, this is still a problem. And now we have these biologics that have been thrown in the mix. So, for instance, here, hospitalized infection within 30 days occurred in 270 of 4,288 surgeries, which was about 6.3% of an infection risk. And there were several things, though, that they noticed that were associated with this infection risk. That included the fact that if they were older, of course, had a lot of comorbidities, if they'd had revision surgery or had been hospitalized with infection, of course, they had an increased risk for a postoperative infection. What they found, though, that surprised them and it surprised me, and that is that even though these patients had had infliximab 4 weeks prior to their surgery, there was no increased risk of infection for the sake of the infliximab that they received. You might say, whoa, how could that be? Well, obviously, there must be something with the timing of when they get their immunosuppressive medicine and when they have their surgery done. Something similar was found here. So these are patients who had rituximab treatment and then underwent surgery. And they had 133 patients, 140 procedures total, 94 orthopedic surgeries, and 23 abdominal surgeries. And what they found was that if they received their rituximab greater than a median of 4.3 months before their surgery, there was no increased risk of an infection, except for patients who had spine surgery. That was the only exception. So the timing is important. And you'll see in just a minute that for most of us, when we give you a recommendation about when to do surgery after rituximab, we're going to tell you 6 months after when the rituximab is due. But there is some evidence that giving it 4 months before procedure is safe to do. So in 2017, they decided to look at this and say, well, what is the risk of surgery with these medications, and how about giving us some recommendations about timing and when to hold them and when to restart them? And so they looked at this. This was a joint effort between orthopedic surgeons and rheumatologists, and it was co-published in 2017 in August and September in an orthopedic journal and in the rheumatology journal. It was comprised of a panel of rheumatologists, orthopedic surgeons, who got together, and they discussed and included the use of DMARD therapy, biologics, the tofacitinib, the JAK inhibitor, and others. And then they also looked at patients not just with rheumatoid arthritis, but who had a variety of autoimmune diseases and were immunosuppressed. And these are the recommendations boiled down. So they said that we should continue the oral DMARD therapy through surgery, which I have to pause and think about. My teaching was always to hold it at least 2 weeks prior to make sure that surgery goes well without complication, and then start it again 2 weeks after the surgeon has seen the patient and verified that everything is clean, dry, and intact, and that there are no complications. But their recommendations from 2017 were to continue the oral DMARDs through the procedure. You might say, well, why would that be? There are other studies that show that if you allow the rheumatoid arthritis to flare, it inhibits wound healing. Other recommendations include stopping all biologics before surgery. And what you want to stop the biologic before the next dose is due. So the dosing cycle is key. And I'll go over that in specifics in just a second. And that you don't want to resume your treatment any sooner than 2 weeks after their surgery. Again, I typically will tell people don't take it until you've talked to your surgeon and they verify that everything is clean, dry, intact, and that there's no infection. So what we, again, want you to take away from this is that you can continue the methotrexate, you can continue the leflunomide, the sulfasalazine, the hydroxychloroquine, and even the azathioprine you can include or continue. But we need to discontinue these. And again, there's no way you're going to be able to memorize this, and it'll be on the website, and you'll have access to this. But adalimumab, for instance, because it's dosed every 2 weeks, you want to hold it 2 weeks prior to surgery, through surgery, and then at least 2 weeks after surgery, making sure that everything has gone well without complications. You can see the list here. Etanercept is dosed every week, so you hold that 1 week prior. But again, you don't start it for 2 weeks after surgery to make sure that they're doing okay. Same thing applies with the other TNF inhibitors. Rituxan down at the bottom, again, is dosed typically every 6 months, but again, it can be dosed every year or year and a half, depending on what the patient needs. And so you look at that last dose, and you don't want to do surgery if they've had a dose typically within 6 months. You'll have to delay the surgery. Now, I had one question about what about emergencies? Well, that's a different issue. If you have an emergency, you do the surgery. And then if there are complications with infection, you treat the infection. Some of the others, tocilizumab, abatacept, for instance, is given as a weekly injected dose by the patient, but they can also receive it as an IV infusion. So it's important to understand how they get their abatacept. Because if it's the weekly injection, you basically hold it 1 week before, like the Enbrel. I did again, sorry, etanercept. Okay, and then if they're getting the IV infusion, you would hold it and not do surgery for 4 weeks after they got that dose. Anakinra is the one. Now, this is another reason why it's not very popular, interleukin-1. It's dosed every single day. They inject themselves every single day, so they don't like it very much. But you can hold it the day before, which is kind of nice when you're heading into surgery. So there is an ever-growing list of fantastic medicines that are being developed and that are available for our use to help patients with rheumatoid arthritis. The classification criteria for RA are available for anyone to use if you'd like to. And then the guidelines are available to help us direct therapy, and it comes out every 3 to 4 years. Very, very helpful. The patients who receive or who are going to receive immunosuppressive therapy should receive vaccinations, which you can help me with. And when you're looking for specific guidelines for vaccinations, they're available on the CDC website, /vaccines, and then /ACIP. And then it's important that we time surgery carefully around the time that they get their immunosuppressive therapy. And I, for one, know as a rheumatologist, I appreciate phone calls that I get from interested providers and surgeons who want to know about these things. We don't expect you to understand the intricacies of these medications. So if you do have a surgeon, there is concern for that, call the patient's rheumatologist and just discuss it quickly, and we can answer those questions. I'd like to thank you for your time today and be happy to take any questions.
So I always get a little nervous with your patients when I'm seeing them in an urgent setting. Looks like a cold, sounds like a cold. Can you give us any guidelines as far as when we need to do antibiotics and when we can assume it is the cold that's going around?
Okay, so that's a great question. The question was, I get a little nervous when patients are on immunosuppression and they come in with a cold. What do I do with that? So I go back to the history and physical exam, and I still rely on that. So I don't give everybody an antibiotic because they come in with cold-like symptoms. If members of the family have had similar symptoms and they've come and gone, I do a careful head and neck exam, looking for adenopathy, looking in their ears. I'll look in their mouth, their throat. I'll listen to their heart and lungs. I'm very careful about that. These diseases affect the whole system, and so I try and use good judgment about how to do that. If they've had cold-like symptoms for greater than 2 weeks, and things seem to be getting worse, I'll treat them with an antibiotic, and it depends on what their symptoms are. So if they have what sounds like a sinus infection, I'll treat them for a sinus infection. If it sounds like they've got a productive cough, I will get a chest x-ray. And if I'm concerned in the least that they may need an antibiotic, I'll go ahead and give it to them. I'm always happy when my patients come in and they say, well, my primary care doctor saw me, I had 2 weeks of symptoms, I was really miserable. They weren't sure what was going on, but they gave me an antibiotic, and I'm feeling quite a bit better. You know, that's always nobody's going to argue with you for that. So I would just say, be careful, good history and physical exam, and use good judgment. And then I would have a low threshold for giving an antibiotic.
I noticed you said they give the HPV virus injections. Is that still less than 28 years old? Do you give it to the older population?
I don't know that they were clear on the website about that. They just said males and females HPV. To be honest with you, I was hoping that question wouldn't come up because I don't know.
Okay.
And the reason why I say this is, you know, I wasn't trained to use the HPV vaccine. And in our Utah community, oftentimes there is some kickback against the HPV vaccine. And I don't typically give it. And so I appreciate the question. The ACIP website would be a good resource to go to.
Thank you.
So when dealing with acute infection, I know you talked about preoperative and surgical complications, but when a patient comes in, you know, for IV antibiotics, obviously the biologics are appropriate to be aware of and stop. Are the DMARDs also always appropriate to stop in those cases, or can those be continued at times?
That's a great question. Thank you. So oral DMARDs we will typically also stop. Remember, they are immunosuppressive. And so if someone comes in with their methotrexate or their azathioprine and they do have an infection, I typically will advise them to hold the medication for a week or two, depending on how their treatment goes with their antibiotic. Typically, once the fever clears, if they have a fever, their symptoms improve over 3 to 4 days, they're probably safe to restart their oral DMARD, but I usually will give them at least a week to see where the infection's gonna go.
In like cardiology with like atrial fibrillation, we have like the Hasblood score that helps us guide to say, you know, when is anticoagulation not gonna be safe. In rheumatology, do we have some similar guideline to say how many infections are going to be enough before we have to say, let's not do the immunosuppressant
therapy? Wow, that's a great question, too. So obviously, we're not just talking about functionality of these patients. We're talking about pain, and many of them are suffering with these diseases. When the joints are inflamed and sore and hurt, people can't move, they can't get out of bed, they will do anything to feel better. And I do have patients who have reached that plateau where you realize with their infection risk and so on, there's really nothing that can be done. Most of the time that doesn't happen. Usually we can find a graded response of immunosuppression to help these patients. But if they have an active infection, all bets are off. They don't get an immunosuppressive. I have one patient recently who I think she's on her second or third septic prosthetic joint. And I saw her this week and told her, I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do for you until this is completely cleared, and it might be months. She came in with her PICC line and her story, and there was absolutely nothing we could do. And in that situation, it's pain control. And so obviously, we don't want to put them in the ground with immunosuppression. Our first tentative course is do no harm. And so there are situations where the risk of infection outweighs the benefit of the therapy, and that does happen. But typically, we can find something to put them on to help them. Even sometimes if it's very low-dose prednisone. Remember that rheumatoid arthritis responds beautifully to low-dose prednisone. Sometimes I'll see people come in from their provider and they've been given 60 milligrams of prednisone for their rheumatoid. That's not necessary. You can get a lot done with 10 milligrams of oral prednisone once a day with rheumatoid arthritis. It significantly improves symptoms. And there are times when I'll keep somebody on a very low dose of prednisone, maybe some sulfasalazine, which isn't particularly immunosuppressive, and then we cross our fingers and hope for the best. But again, a phone call, I'm happy to take phone calls about questions like that. Thank you very much.
Thanks to our speakers for a wonderful session. We now have a 30-minute break, and at 10 o'clock, you have choices to make. In this room, we're going to have a panel of some of the pillars of our medical community who are going to be talking about pearls from the past. Next door over here, the divider's going to come in. We're going to be talking about shock. And then at the 11 o'clock hour in here, we're going to have a discussion on some of the adventures of locum tenens work. And on this side of the hall, we're going to be talking about autism spectrum disorder. Again, we have a 30-minute break. Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight.
Find that one?
Okay. Of course it is. Maybe five here? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. One, two.
They're coming back.
Check, check.
It's nice to meet you. I've heard so much.